It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. We have an amazing show for you today. Each week, I think about who I can bring on that are making the world better, that are giving back. And today I'm honored to have the good Dr. Michael Ingber, an amazing urogynecological expert. He's had so much expertise in the medical field. And what he's doing is he's not just doing amazing things here in Morristown through Morristown Medical Center, his wonderful skill set local, but he's going to Africa. And he's involved with Growing Hearts of Africa. And it's an amazing story. It's a compelling story. Someone local going all the way around the world on the journey of giving. And it's really an amazing honor. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. And as I just indicated, Doc, you know, I was doing some research about your background. I know you're fellowship trained at the Cleveland Clinic, and you have tremendous expertise. You're board certified in urology, and I know that's your passion to help others. And one of the things that I was struck by was your tremendous innovative surgical techniques and the things that you've been able to learn over the many years of practice in your specialty. Doc, if I may, since for the listener's benefit and really for my benefit, I want to ask you some questions about, you know, where you're from originally. I know we're here in the Garden State, and I understand you came from the great state of Michigan. Is that where you were born and raised?
That's correct, yeah. I grew up in Michigan, southeast Michigan, Detroit suburbs, and a town called West Bloomfield, Michigan, and grew up there with an older brother, older sister, and a lot of my family members still live there. I was the first one to move out of the state.
So what's it like living here in New Jersey? Is it different from how you were raised?
It's great here. My wife, Lori, grew up in Westfield, and we always knew we wanted to be near family, and so it was time to move out near her family. So love the area. I love New Jersey. It's been great.
Yeah, I'm born and raised in New Jersey. I actually grew up in Springfield, so I know Westfield quite well. So doctor, I wanted to talk about, basically, I'm always interested in how people get on the journey of giving, but also just how you picked, you know, you're an expert in urological procedures. And how'd you get involved in medicine? Because I'm a trial lawyer. I was blessed to work with my late dad, and he was my hero. And everybody asked me, why did I become a lawyer? And I can simply say, my dad. And he had so many, you know, positive influences on my life. Why did you pick medicine?
I remember as a kid always being interested in anatomy and understanding all the different organ systems and how they work together. And I even have a memory of when I was a little kid and my goldfish died, and I asked my parents, can I dissect it? And they said yes. And I remember dissecting the goldfish and seeing the different organs and just being really interested in all of that. So that's what led me down the path into becoming a doctor.
Did you have a family member, someone that you looked up to that was in medicine that you thought would be an interesting field to pursue?
We actually didn't have any medical doctors in my family. My father and my brother were both dentists, or are both dentists. They're still practicing today. I thought about becoming a dentist for a little bit. I thought, you know, anything in the medical field is interesting, but originally I thought maybe I wanted to be a heart surgeon or a brain surgeon. I always liked surgery.
Interesting. I was not great in the sciences, so I just, that part of the brain, I think, just didn't develop the way it probably would certainly need to be. So in terms of your medical specialization and in terms of the abilities that you've been able to really have groundbreaking procedures, and I don't want to get too deep into it, but I was fascinated by this whole concept of single port incisions, and you've done some tremendous things. Can you outline just a little bit of the groundbreaking, revolutionary surgical procedures you've been involved in? Because I was really struck by it.
Sure. Well, I was fortunate to train at two really good institutions. In urology, I trained at a place called William Beaumont Hospital in Southeast Michigan. And there I did 6 years of general surgery training and then pelvic surgery training. They were doing innovative therapies, everything from reattaching your spinal nerves to help you urinate better to bladder and bowel pacemakers. And when I finished there, I kind of knew I wanted to go into pelvic surgeries. And we can actually further specialize in urology and become a urogynecological surgeon and do reconstructive surgeries. And so I did 2 extra years at the Cleveland Clinic. And at the Cleveland Clinic, they're doing some really interesting surgeries. We were doing everything from, single port usually with laparoscopic surgery, you make 5 tiny incisions throughout the body. And single port is where you make 1 incision, usually in a natural orifice like the belly button. And it basically turns a bigger surgery and longer surgery into a scarless, minimally invasive surgery where patients can go home the same day on just Tylenol. It's really truly amazing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like way back. I know that individuals would go for surgery. They could be in the hospital for a few weeks under these tremendous innovative procedures. Now, what's the normal turnaround time for the patient's, stability where they can be discharged to go home?
Yeah, so that's a good question. For example, the old way of doing a hysterectomy was where we would make an incision, like in the bikini line, and we would remove the uterus, and women would be in the hospital for traditionally 3 or 4 days, sometimes 5 days. Laparoscopic surgery came out really in the 90s. It was, developed, and that allowed us to do these same kind of surgeries, and patients would be able to stay in the hospital overnight and go home the next day. That evolved into what we call robotic surgery now, where there's actually a robotic technology that controls the laparoscopic instruments, and the patient's on the operating table, and I'm in the room with the patient, but I'm actually sitting in the corner of a room controlling a robotic console that does all the surgeries. Robotic surgery now makes it easier for us to do these surgeries and send patients home the same day with less blood loss, less pain, and quicker recovery.
So in terms of this incredible groundbreaking procedures you're doing, have you ever done anything that was basically the first time the world had ever seen that procedure?
Yeah, so after we moved to New Jersey, I did the first reported single-port uterine suspension surgery. So there was one patient in the area who did not want scars and was offered the traditional robotic surgery by some others in the area. I offered her what's called a single port uterine suspension. So what we did was we went through her belly button with 1 little incision and we lifted her uterus as opposed to removing it. So that was the first time that was ever done in the world. And we published that in the journal, in one of the surgical journals, Updates in Surgery. And it was really neat. We had WNBC in New York came out and interviewed us at the time, both myself and the patient, because it was a groundbreaking surgery. It was really, really fun.
That's a beautiful thing. I mean, to think about, here I am, for the listeners, with the world-renowned urological surgeon, pelvic surgery. It's really an incredible honor, Doc. So at some point, you get this skill set that's really remarkable. And you practice here local out of Morristown Medical Center where you're doing your procedures?
Yeah, I have 2 offices. I have an office in Morristown off of James Street. And I have an office in Denville on Route 10. Practice out of both places. We have the Women's Urological Center, and is really the headquarters is on Route 10 in Denville. And then we actually have a medical spa there too, where we do some cosmetic procedures as well.
Yeah, my office is on Route 10. Maybe I could stop by for a little cosmetic.
Anytime.
Little cosmetic, lift me up.
Not that you need it, Tom.
Oh, you're kind and generous because you like my intro about you, Doc. But I appreciate it nonetheless. So I want to get into your head a little bit, Doc. So you've got this incredible skill. You're a groundbreaking surgeon. You're changing lives local. And at some point, I'm learning about who you are and your family and your background. And you get involved with Growing Hearts of Africa. And I want to explore that in some detail. But before I get that far, I want to first understand, who influenced you? What are the things that made you decide it just can't be about me and building up a practice, but I want to give back. I want to make the world better. Do you have some influences in your life that led you to the path of giving back?
Yeah, I think my parents always taught me that it was important to give back to the community. And even going back, before my parents, my grandparents came to this country, and they really didn't grow up with much. I remember my grandfather, my father's father, used to, whenever we went out to eat, He would never eat potatoes, and I always wondered why that was, and I learned later that it was when he was growing up, he was very poor, and that was all they could afford to eat was just potatoes, mashed potatoes, roast potatoes, and so he just, you know, once he built up his business and worked hard, and he built a successful auto business in Ann Arbor, Michigan, he taught us to give back. My father always taught me to give back. I remember even as a kid, my dad would always bring me into our local synagogue where we would house the homeless for a week, and we would feed them and give them clothes, and you know, my dad's the kind of guy that will give a stranger the shirt off his back if they need it. So, you know, I think both my parents and my grandparents always taught us it was important to give back and give thanks for what we have.
Did you know as a young person, you know, the beautiful spirit of your parents and grandparents about giving back and lifting up others? Did you recognize that at an early age?
I think I did. I think it's important to teach that as a parent at a young age, and my wife and I are trying to do that with our kids too, always teaching them, even though we have the means, that there's plenty of others around the world and both and locally too who are in need. So you know, my kids are always helping others. I know my wife and my youngest kid this the past year they went through Table of Hope in Morristown, and they delivered groceries to those in need and the elderly in the area. So it's just always something important values that we're trying to instill into our children.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm a proud father of two wonderful kids, two boys, and I do my best to set an example. They never had the chance to meet my parents, sadly, but I always try to carry on their spirit of giving back and trying to be a role model, because I realize it changes their trajectory, because they see it's not just about them, it's about also the world, because I think that's critically important. You know, so in talking about the world, so I want to talk about the Growing Hearts of Africa and the genesis of it, because in researching it, I know you have an incredible sister-in-law, right, Alyssa Maisano?
I have three incredible sisters-in-law.
Oh, my God. There you go. You say,
can't leave out the other ones. Four incredible sisters-in-law.
You would be in trouble at the next family get-together. My apologies to, you know, your wonderful sister-in-laws. That's plural.
Two involved in the organization.
Well, that's right. So thank you for covering me just slightly. So in terms of the sister-in-laws and that tradition. So, you know, before I go there with the sister-in-law, obviously your wife, right, Lori? Where'd you meet your wife?
So my wife and I met at the University of Michigan. She was a couple years behind me there, and we were introduced by her good friend, who happened to be my fraternity brother. We were set up on a blind date.
This is in Wolverine Country, University of Michigan.
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
There you go. So, so when you met your future wife, and then you got married, and you know, you're raising your family, but did you understand that your wife was also involved in giving back, and there was a commonality in terms of your spirit and her spirit of giving back?
Yeah, I think my wife's parents, my in-laws, are very similar to my parents, and that they always taught their kids to give back to others. And you know, my wife didn't grow up wealthy, and her, you know, her family grew up originally in Connecticut and later moved to New Jersey. Over time, her parents always took in foster children into the home. So that was something that was always important to my in-laws, and they instilled those values in their kids. And, I think that's what probably led to everyone in the family choosing to adopt as well. So my older sister-in-law has both biological and adopted children. My younger sister-in-law also has both biological and adopted children, and we have two adopted children as well, and two biological children.
That's a beautiful thing. I love families that, you know, basically bring in other new family members and adopt and give those children an opportunity. I think that's certainly wonderful. So the Growing Hearts of Africa, so I was trying to get my hands around Africa. I know it's an incredibly large continent. I'll be honest, I don't know very much about Africa. And I was out and I was talking to my neighbor, and shout out to Justin if you're listening, and we were talking about Africa, and I didn't really understand Africa very much, to be honest. I'd simply never been. I don't understand the continent. So in terms of the Growing Hearts of Africa, because I realized the word Africa is a major part of this, the name Growing Hearts of Africa, how did that come about?
Well, the organization was originally started by kind of a couple of us. So my sister-in-law, Alyssa, and myself both separately became involved in charitable giving through Africa. So when I was a resident at William Beaumont Hospital in Michigan, we had a wealthy donor back there who donated to our program to allow residents studying urology to go anywhere in the world for a month fully funded. And so many of my colleagues chose to go to places like Hawaii or, you know, Europe and do rotations. And I chose to go to Zambia and you know, sub-Saharan Africa. And I ran what's called a vesco-vaginal fistula camp. So this is women who have had who were in labor, who had obstructed labor where the fetus gets stuck and there's nobody to do a C-section to get the baby out. And these women suffer and basically usually the baby dies and they're left with holes in their bladder where they chronically leak urine. And it's a bad problem because not only do these women get shunned from their communities, oftentimes their husbands divorce them and then they're left suffering with just chronic leakage of urine. And there's nobody there to fix these issues. So as a trained pelvic surgeon, I went over there with some other doctors and we did these surgeries for these women in Zambia.
But why Africa? So you talked about the different opportunities through a wonderful donor willing to give different opportunities all over the globe, the world. Why Zambia?
Well, you know, this problem is a very unique problem, and we don't really see this in many other parts of the world. In the United States, we rarely see fistulas, sometimes after pelvic surgeries. Sometimes we see them in South America, but it's a big problem in sub-Saharan Africa and everywhere from Nigeria to Ethiopia to Uganda to Zambia, Angola. There's a famous book called Cutting for Stone, which is really good if anyone wants to read it, but about fistula. We had a rotating doctor from Zambia who came to my institution at Beaumont in Michigan. His name was John Kachimba. He's a 6'5" tall Zambian guy, great guy. And he was with us to learn the surgeries that we do. And so he was the one I connected with to go back to Zambia. And he connected me with a couple other doctors there to help run this fistula camp. And it was really life-changing, the experience there.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. I always think about how you can meet someone and your whole trajectory in life can change. You could go in one direction and then all of a sudden someone touches your heart or influences you in a way. And then you look back retrospectively and like, oh, my God, that made a huge difference on the path, on my journey in life. Would you say meeting the doctor was one of those scenarios where it puts you on a whole different path?
Yeah, John is fortunate. You know, he's a physician in Zambia. And, you know, so physicians, you know, they don't do as well in Zambia as they do in the U.S. I think his salary was a couple hundred dollars a month, he was telling me at the time. But you know, he lives a decent life over there and has money for an apartment. But he was telling me about all the patients of his who really don't have the means, and they survive on pennies a day and are starving. And then he was telling me about the fistula problem over in his area. So I, you know, when I met him originally in Michigan, he was really the one that led me to go to Zambia and want to give back in that way.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible, just how that the doctor really changed your life and touched it in a way. So where were you living at that time? You were in Michigan still?
Yeah, so I was in Southeast Michigan, a place called Royal Oak, Michigan, Detroit suburbs, and that's where my wife and I were living.
So at some point, you're going to go to Africa for the first time. How many years ago was that?
Oh, man, I'm at the age where I don't remember how, you know, time periods, but it was about 15, 16 years ago.
Okay. I can ask a guy, how old are you, Doc?
I'm 45.
Well, you look great, too, for your age. Well, you were a young man when you decided to go to Africa. So what was that like? So I always wonder when you're on the journey of giving and you're going to do something totally new, you know, there's a level that, I mean, I get nervous or concerned or fearful. What was your mindset when you're going to go from United States of America and you're going to go into Africa and you obviously have some understanding of what it's like there? What was your frame of mind?
You know, it's always there's a little bit of anxiety because you don't know what you're getting into. And my mother is a nervous person. I remember her being very nervous for me to go. And the one thing I remember her telling me is to bring cans of tuna fish so I could always have something to eat. But at the time we had to go to a infectious disease specialist to make sure we got all our shots. I had to get yellow fever shots and diphtheria, tetanus. I had to take malaria prophylaxis. Malaria is big over there. I was a little nervous to go, but I knew I at least knew one person, which was Dr. Kachimba over there. So I met him initially. And then later became very close with a couple other physicians that live in Africa that I do a lot of these trips with.
So on your first mission to Africa, I understand you've already outlined you had to go with these prophylactic measures, these vaccines, and obviously your mom is nervous. I can understand why. And when you land, you land in what country you landed in Africa?
Well, I think I connected through Dubai at the time. So we went to Dubai, and it was a 10-hour trip there, and then it was another 10 hours or so to Zambia. We landed in Lusaka, the capital of Zambia.
Yeah. Once again, I mean, I should have had my glow back. I'm a little bit lost on this. A little tuna fish story.
Yeah.
I used to love tuna fish. Believe it or not, I liked it with ketchup. I don't know why, but I did. Now, if I saw a can of tuna fish, I would run the other way. But that's life. Your tastes change. So, Doc, as the listeners are learning more about you and your mission and your passion, we're going to really dig deep. If they're listening, they might want to Google and research Growing Hearts of Africa. What's the website?
Yeah, the website is growingheartsofafrica.com. Again, growingheartsofafrica.com. And there's some pictures of what we do there. There's some stories. There's ways to donate. And it's not only a medical charity where we help fund surgeries and medical care throughout Africa, but we also help build schools throughout Africa.
Yeah, no question. We're going to touch on that, too. But as the listeners are getting a better feel of you and the mission, and I was so struck by all the things you've been doing. So let's get to that. So you're in Africa, you meet the doctor, you're going to now start to provide really world-class medical care that I'm assuming where you're going, they have like no experience or exposure to a doctor of your skill set. Is that a fair way to discuss it?
Yeah, Africa is an interesting place. In most of the capital cities, you can find luxury, hotels and nice apartments and good food and good health care. But in some of these places, when you travel a little further away from the capital, it's very different. So in Zambia, we were in Lusaka, which is the capital, and they have a teaching hospital there. They have decent health care. And then you travel a few hours away to a place called Munze, which is where we did our initial work. And we worked at a hospital called Munze Mission Hospital, and it was a hospital funded by the Catholic Church. I stayed in a house there in Munze where there was no running water, no electricity. And I stayed in a house with, I call it a house, but it was really a roof with walls. There was really nothing else in there. I stayed with a couple who, were in the Peace Corps at the time. I remember the snakes around and cockroaches, crawling in our room. It's very different there than any other place in the United States. There's really very little that they have there. And I remember, the gentleman I stayed with, Tony told me, listen, at night when you walk back from the hospital at night, make sure that you stomp really hard on the ground very loudly as you walk back. And I said, well, why would I have to do that? And he said, well, because there's poisonous vipers and snakes and you don't want to get bit by one of them. And if they hear and feel the rumbling on the ground, they'll generally, move away. And I said, well, what happens if I do get bit by one? He said, well, then you're dead.
Oh.
Because there's no anti-venom that we have here.
Wow. I'll say, listen, hopefully today was a little safer coming to this fine studio.
So I didn't tell my mom about that.
I was going to say, forget about the tuna fish. You would have been out of there. So did you have a clue, Doc, when you were going to embark on this first mission that basically your life was literally in jeopardy? Did you have any understanding of that?
No, I knew it was not going to be as safe in general as being in the U.S. But the reality is most of these places I go to are safe in the sense of there's they don't have as much gang, you know, violence as some of the inner cities do in, here in the U.S. They don't have as much, gun violence as the U.S. You know, there's some theft in everywhere you go in Africa, but in general, I wasn't too concerned about my safety.
But obviously the snakes, everybody has their own phobias and fears. I don't like snakes. So was that something like when you were like walking through and you're stomping and you're obviously highly intelligent, you understand if there's no anti-venom, you got a huge problem. What was that just like, you know, there you're doing the right thing. You're making the world better all the way really around the globe, but you're literally in a whole different environment. Is that just like when you're, is it hard to process, or are you just kind of like in the moment and you just deal with it?
Yeah, you know, once you're there, you sort of roll with it and you learn very quickly how to live. And, one of the reasons why we would walk back in the dark at night is because, we would operate from sunlight to sundown. In the operating room, there was a generator, that they had that powered some of our surgical instruments and powered, some portable lights in the room. But a lot of times the generator would go out. And so we really would rely on the natural sunlight in order to operate. So we would operate from when the sun went up to when the sun went down, because after that we couldn't see anymore. So once the sun went down, it was dark, that's when we left and leave for the day.
That's pretty incredible. I mean, to think about it, I know you work right out of one of the fine, really, medical institutions, Morristown Medical Center, and you go to this environment, and it's hard for me to get my hands around the concept. You're doing these very, you know, critically sensitive surgical procedures to give these young ladies a new lease on life, but you're doing it under such difficult circumstances. So is that also where you kind of roll with it and you're like, I don't know what procedures, you know, you have to go through to make sure everything's sanitized and everything is, you know, as safe as possible. And I'm assuming, maybe I'm wrong, but all the wonderful equipment here in the United States is probably not available to you. So what is that like in terms of just working with what you have?
Yeah, you mentioned sanitized equipment, and that's one thing that's a little crazy over there. In some of these areas, they don't have the proper sterilization equipment. So in Zambia, they did have a steam autoclave, which is, you know, what cleans the machine that cleans a lot of our surgical instruments. But I remember putting on a surgical gown for the first time. Usually here in the United States, we have disposable gowns. We rip open the package, and it's a sterile gown we put on. Over there, they would have cloth gowns that we would wear, which work fine in general. They would come out from the steam autoclave, so they'd be a little moist and hot, and you put them on, and there were a lot of holes in them, and you look at your, you know, hands, which are supposed to be sterile, and you have your sterile gloves on, but you look at your arm, and there's all these holes throughout your gown, and you're just wondering how we could do this. But that's all they have there. And, you know, so a lot of these places when we go, we bring a lot of the sterile, you know, equipment and disposable equipment. I remember in Uganda, there was they had no running water in the hospital. So we would have the villagers in the beginning of the day would take a big garbage pail, and they would go to the river. They would take the garbage pail of water and bring it up to our surgical scrub sink. And that's what we would scrub with. It was river water that we were washing our hands with. So we had sterile medical soap that we brought, but there was no, clean water to really wash our hands in.
So can you, I want to get a feel of the actual surgical procedures, because I was fascinated by the single port, procedure, and just how it provides such a much quicker healing time from what I'm hearing and researched. Are you doing those groundbreaking techniques under these difficult circumstances there?
Yeah, most of the time in these places in sub-Saharan Africa, we don't have the equipment to do single port laparoscopy and those kinds of surgeries. We do some other minimally invasive pelvic surgeries though. So for example, the most common surgery I do here in the United States is something called a suburethral sling. And that's a 12-minute surgery that fixes leakage when women cough, sneeze, and laugh. One in four women have that here if you've had a baby before. It's very easy, actually, for both me and the patient. Women go home on Tylenol afterwards. The old traditional surgeries that we would do were much bigger, longer surgeries with a little longer recovery, where we'd have to take a piece of women's, you know, muscle covering called fascia. It was a little more painful for women. They evolved in the 1980s to, synthetic sling surgeries. And then even over the last decade, they've evolved to what's called a single incision sling, where I can make one little tiny incision just, under a half an inch transvaginal, where there's no incision that you can see. And we do these surgeries. So I actually have the companies that provide these products donate to our foundation, and when we go, we do some of these surgeries there that these women wouldn't traditionally have access to.
Yeah, wonderful. We're going to take a very quick break. We're going to be back in 30 seconds with the good Dr. Michael Ingber.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Michael Ingber, a renowned, really a world-class doctor right here out of Morristown, and it's a real honor to have him on. So, Dr. Ingber, you were really talking about the different surgical procedures that, certainly are in your repertoire and what you can deliver in Africa. And I realize, the circumstances are different and what you can do if you don't have the robotic equipment. But basically, correct me if I'm wrong, you're changing these patients' lives in Africa. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah, these women traditionally don't have access to, surgeries, obviously, but even access to medical care. A lot of times in the United States, when women are in labor, if they have trouble, delivering the baby vaginally, they'll have an obstetrician who's available to do a C-section or extract the baby with a vacuum, delivery or forceps. Here in a lot of these, in Africa, a lot of these villages that are far away from the capital cities where there's little healthcare, oftentimes it's a local healer that's doing the extraction of the baby they're oftentimes the cause of these fistulas.
So that was something that was also striking is, and all due respect to the wonderful people in Africa, but how backward it seemed to me in terms of just the level of healthcare. It's almost non-existent in certain areas, which in 2022 seems almost mind-boggling to me. What was that like? Because you've been giving back all these years now. So when you started there 15 years ago, approximately, you had to feel your boots are on the ground. Hopefully away from the snakes, but you're there, you're delivering world-class medicine, but you're dealing with such a backward, all these different countries, they appear just backwards to me. So what was your reaction as you started to be so committed to the African nations?
Yes, every country there is different, and so a lot of times the government does fund the healthcare there, and so there's a little bit of funding in some of these areas. There's also a lot of private healthcare institutions, so if you have money in these places, you can pay to go to a well-trained doctor and get good care. But if you don't have money, you're reliant on the government healthcare system, which oftentimes is a little less funded, and you don't get as properly trained physicians over there. So it's really, it is mind-boggling to see, the lack of access. And it really comes down to, in a lot of these areas, the lack of educated physicians that they put out. So, some of these countries in the capital cities, they do have medical schools and they'll produce physicians. The challenge is really getting physicians and nurses who are trained well to go outside of these capital cities and these population centers into the rural communities to provide care.
Right. So, from what I'm gathering, there's a huge disparity, if I may, like a tale of two cities. I use that analogy. If you're in the city, you have a pretty good chance of having some good medical care and you have a pretty good chance of getting better. The further you get from the capitals, it gets more and more backwards in terms of just what's available by the way the medical delivery system. Sounds like in certain areas it's pretty much non-existent. So if a woman has these incredibly challenging problems on so many levels, we all understand if you can't hold your urine, it's a big problem. And obviously there's so many other social issues that come about. So as you've developed such a close relationship with Africa, and you've been going back with the Growing Heart of Africa for over 15 years, what is your perspective? Are things getting better there?
I think so. I think things are getting better. A couple of reasons. One is, some of these local governments are funding more more nursing students, more physicians. And also there's a lot of non-government organizations and, charities like ours that are helping, fund some of the medical care. You know, one of our goals is not only to help build schools throughout Africa and to help fund surgeries that we do, but also to make things more sustainable. So we want to be able to train local medical personnel to be there on the ground, on a more permanent basis.
Right. I mean, there's no question doctors like you and the Growing Hearts of Africa are changing the world. And that was one of the exciting things and the honor to have someone of your pedigree on to talk about that. So let's go back a little bit in time. So you're going to Africa. You've been putting the time in. You've been doing incredible life-altering, changing surgical procedures. What's it like when you come back to the United States of America? What's the feeling you have when you land? I know you live in Jersey. Let's say, do you fly ultimately to Newark Airport?
Usually either to JFK or Newark. We'll fly back.
All right. So let's say you're back in the United States of America, and your feet, you're back here now. Do you put some things in perspective in terms of just how you feel about being in the United States compared to Africa?
Absolutely. So, it really kind of teaches you to be grateful for what we have here. We have, we live in the greatest country in the world with the greatest health care. And, even simple things like my first week in Zambia, I told you we had no running water. So I didn't shower for the whole week that I was there. And, on my way back to the United States, I did stay in I think it was a Sheraton at the time at the local, Capital Airport, and I took a shower, and I just remember just being thankful for hot water and just that feeling. I remember when I came back as a resident, I had a unique experience where I had just gotten back from Africa treating these women with fistula, and I remember a patient I had, and I was taking care of her, and I walked out of the room. She said, "Excuse me, doctor," as I was walking out, she said, "Can you please make a note on my chart for me that I like lemon in my water, please?" And I just remember that moment stuck out in my head of just thinking about, how great we have it here in the United States.
Right,
that was that woman's, biggest issue of the day. It really teaches you to be grateful for what we have here. We have great medical care. We have housing. We have, for the most part, whereas people in some of these areas have, nothing and live on pennies a day.
That's got to be very humbling, and certainly you seem like an incredible person and so grateful for everything you have and what you experienced here. So in terms of the family involvement, so your wife, Lori, does she accompany you to Africa?
So my wife and her two sisters kind of run the educational aspect of the foundation. So we actually don't travel together, and I have four children, and so we ideally don't leave them behind. So my sister-in-law Alyssa, the story behind that part of the organization is she was trained in special education. She was a special education teacher. She always wanted to adopt as well, just like us. And one of the countries she thought she wanted to adopt from was Ethiopia. I don't remember the special connection she felt she had there, but long story short, she did not adopt from Ethiopia. She ended up adopting two beautiful children from Alabama, who are now 13, just had their bat mitzvah. But she always felt a special connection to Ethiopia.
Well, mazel tov on the bar mitzvah too.
Thank you. It was great. So after that connection, she decided that she wanted to raise money to help build a school there. And the amazing thing about our organization is that, while it may take millions of dollars to build a school in the United States, in Ethiopia at the time, it was $23,000 to build a school. And so she raised enough money to build a school, and she started her own, Africa-related charity, and built her first school. And, you know, the two of us separately having these ties to Africa and charities over time decided to sort of merge, and we formed the Growing Hearts of Africa Foundation. So my wife and her two sisters travel throughout Africa when they open schools, and we've built over, you know, well over a dozen schools throughout Ethiopia and Uganda.
That's awesome. I mean, I'm hearing just wonderful things. You know, your sister-in-law, your wife, you know, your other sister-in-law is so involved to really change the trajectory of those folks with 12 schools, well, from at least 12 now, right, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And that also, we know the importance of education. Education really is really, I think, without education, it's hard to really be successful in life. So in terms of, like, some experiences there that are, like, stand out in your mind from going there and bringing this wonderful level of healthcare. Are there some stories that stand out? How you know, you really just right there, you change some lives. Can you give us a story or two about that, Doc?
Sure. I have many, but there are a couple that really stand out of just kind of crazy stories that we had. I do remember when I was in Angola a few years ago. We were there for a fistula camp, so we were treating, you know, pelvic. We were doing surgeries on women with bladder leakage, and we land in the capital of Angola, which is Luanda, which is actually one of the wealthiest cities in Africa, believe it or not. But when you travel by car about 10 hours out toward the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, there's a place there called Damba, very poor region where there's not much there. There's a, you know, building that they call a hospital, but there's no doctors that run it. And we do a camp there every so often. And I remember that I was there with a surgeon friend of mine who's originally from Italy, and now lives in Luanda, the capital of Angola, and he does general surgery. So we were there to run a women's vesico-vaginal fistula camp, and we had probably, you know, 20 or 30 women that had hiked from all sorts of areas throughout the country. Some came from the Congo and came across the border. Some we actually brought in a van with us from Luanda, took the 10-hour drive with us. But while we were there, a woman showed up with her 10-year-old boy and said, "I need help. I heard there was an American-trained doctor here, and my son is not well." And he was 10 years old, and he looked like he was on death's doorstep. And we, you know, while we were there for a women's fistula camp, we felt the need to take care of this boy, too. My general surgery colleague and I examined him and realized that he had what we call peritoneal signs. So when we pushed on his belly, his abdomen was rigid and he had severe pain. So we knew something was going on in his abdomen. Now, the problem is that traditionally here in the United States, we would give him general anesthesia and he would be asleep and we'd make an incision. There, we didn't have that. So we had to do an exploratory laparotomy, or basically explore his abdomen with just sedation and a little spinal anesthetic where he gets an injection. So it was, you know, kind of a dangerous situation for patients, but that was all we had, and we knew we had to save this boy's life. So we did that. I remember that we had a student with us from Luanda who came with us. So he was serving as our anesthesiologist and just kind of monitoring the patient's vital signs, making sure he was breathing. And when we opened his abdomen, we found these little perforations in his small intestine. And we took out some of his small intestine, closed some of the holes. And it turns out he had something called typhoid enteritis. So in the United States, we really don't see that. So there's, not only there's a vaccine against it, but there's also antibiotics that traditionally would treat this. But this mother had no access to health care, and these kids who have this problem traditionally would just die. And this boy, fortunately, we were able to save his life. And I got a picture of him a few weeks later when I came back to the United States. Somebody locally was able to get access to internet and send me a picture of him, you know, playing football and kicking a soccer ball around. So it was just great.
I mean, that's a beautiful, incredible story. That I always think about how the good Lord, God, puts you in a place at the right time. I mean, what was that like? You look back now. If you weren't there, it sounds to me like this young boy, this 10-year-old youngster, would have passed.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I became a doctor. I want to help people, and there's no better story than something like that, just to look back and realize this is why I put in all the, you know, it's many years of schooling, many years of hard work, and seeing a, you know, a picture of his smiling face, you know, from the, when he was about to die to, you know, a few weeks later alive and smiling, you know, that kind of puts it all together of why we do this.
Yeah. I mean, you changed a life, you changed a family, you could change the world saving this young 10-year-old boy. But I when I was listening to what you just said, it's the timing that you were there and you had the ability to cure, to help this young boy. And like you said, I mean, that's, I'm sure, part of being a doctor is to deliver that kind of, hopefully, a miracle. And that's, you're a miracle worker, not just there, but you've had other instances, right, Doc, where you and this Growing Hearts of Africa and the wonderful doctors that are committed to bringing such a level of health care to countries that really need it desperately. How do you reflect on it? I mean, what's the impact has that had on your life?
It's had a great impact on my life. I mean, I'm blessed to have been able to, you know, and I'm fortunate to have been able to have this type of education and become a physician and be in a position where I can give back and, you know, to try to teach this to my kids and others and to try to help, you know, bring this type of care and sustainability to other areas in Africa is really, it's wonderful.
So in terms of, you know, I was researching a little bit for the show and about mentors in your life, and I'm correct me if I'm wrong, sound like I'm leading the witness, my apologies, but sometimes it's hard not to do that, but I'm sure you've had some tremendous influences to become such a fine doctor, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had influences both from my family and my parents, and my grandparents, but, you know, also just, you know, other physicians I've trained with who were mentors in my life and you know, teach me not only the surgical skills, but about giving back and helping others in need.
Wonderful. So the reason why I brought that up is because you have this skill that is really world class right here. You deliver it in Morristown, but you go to Africa all these years. How important is it for you and Growing Hearts of Africa and all these other wonderful organizations to get the local doctors to start to elevate their level of education and their skills so that while you're back here in the United States, there's still quality medical care, not just in the capitals in Africa, but in these rural villages, which it sounds like they need it desperately?
Yeah, so that's very important, and that's a good question. And that's really where it starts. It starts with education. So through the educational wing of Growing Hearts of Africa Foundation, we recently funded buildings for 8th and 9th grade teachers to live in a small village in Zambia. So that's one example of what we've done to start educating the children there. In the area I mentioned in Angola, in Damba, in the north near the Congo, there was one local student there who had some nursing training. And while I was there, he mentioned, my dream is to become a doctor. And I said, okay, well, why can't you pursue your dream? What's stopping you? And he said, well, I don't have the money. You know, it's very expensive to go to medical school, and you have to either know somebody or have money in order to go to medical school. And I thought that was interesting. And so I said, well, what if I gave you the money? And what if through our foundation we gave you the money? And he said, that would be wonderful. And I said, would you promise that if we funded your medical education that you would come back to your community and take care of the population here? And he said, absolutely. So I at our gala, at our foundation gala a few years ago, we actually had, as one of our auction items, it was to fund this gentleman's medical education. And so I connected with him again. I told him the news that, one of our local donors was willing to fund his, few years of medical education. He started crying. He was so excited. So he's actually training now in the capital city to become a physician in order to be able to provide care to his community.
Yeah, I mean, that's just beautiful to see local donors, you know, also helping any way they can to lift up this doctor, to lift up the community. These folks that you come in contact with in Africa, what's it like, you know, when you – I know you talked about saving this 10-year-old boy. I mean, God bless you. What a miracle. But were there other instances? I was reading, getting ready for the show about they sang a song. There was something you guys had done that was so beautiful. What was that about?
Yeah, the song that I, so that refers to a time when I was in Uganda. Uganda, we fly into the airport in Entebbe and or Kampala, the capital. We travel a few hours to a small fistula camp there that we did. You know, these women come, and not only do they come from all over the country and spend weeks trying to get there. We hear stories about how, you know, they had to sell their animals in order to provide the funds to find somebody with transportation to take them there. So these women not only are there initially, but they stay throughout the recovery. So when we go to see our post-operative patients, maybe we did 6 surgeries the prior day. We're not only seeing the 6 patients, but we're seeing the 24 other patients that we did the prior days. And they just stay there for weeks throughout the recovery. So I remember one time I came in to see some of our patients that we operated on in one of the wards, which is, it's really just one big room where there's cots there and some women are sleeping on the floor. And they started clapping in unison and they sang this song. It was beautiful. It was all in harmony. And I asked somebody, you know, what are they saying? One of the nurses who was there helping us, and they said they made up a song for you, and the song was called God Brought You Here for Us. So that was really touching. It was really an amazing moment. I'll never forget it.
Amen to that. That's a beautiful story. There's no question about it. For those listening, if they want to donate or get involved with Growing Hearts of Africa, can you give us the website again?
Yeah, so it's growingheartsofafrica.com. GrowingHeartsOfAfrica.com, and there's a little link. You can click donate. You can find information. We usually have a gala once a year. We are always in search of items for our live and our silent auction. So if you have things to donate, if you're a local business, that's always wonderful. You can get in touch with us that way through the website as well.
Yeah, I was reading that some wonderful donors, you raise over $250,000 when you have these galas. Is that a fair, accurate assessment?
Yeah, we've been raising about $250,000 a year, which really, you know, money goes a long way there. So, you know, like I mentioned, it's, you know, for only about $23,000 to $26,000, we can fund an entire building of a school. You know, we just spent $2,000 to build a well in Zambia so a local village near one of the healthcare facilities can have water. We're building homes for teachers to teach the kids, and it's a fraction of what they cost here. So your money really goes a long way.
Right, and I also know you're blessed to have Hayden, who recently had a bar mitzvah. Am I correct?
Hayden's our oldest, and his bar mitzvah was actually about 4 years ago. So the interesting story about Hayden is, you know, traditionally you get gifts and money for your bar mitzvah, and I was really proud of my son when he was having his bar mitzvah. He said to everybody that was coming, he said, "I don't want gifts. What I want you to do is donate money towards the Growing Hearts of Africa Foundation." And he raised enough money to build a school. So it was really, truly amazing. And he gave this gift to our charity. And the school opened in Ethiopia, and it's called the Hayden School. They named it after him.
That's incredible, man. Wow. That's like a wow. You know, I hope my little guys, you know, hopefully you're so blessed and fortunate to follow that kind of example. That's a shining example of a young kid, you know, with his whole life in front of him, understanding the importance of giving back. I want to just, you know, when we were, you know, getting ready for the show, you had me with a few interesting anecdotal stories of just getting around in Africa and some of the issues. That was also, once again, a little staggering for my mind to get around. You're going into Africa, you're trying to make it better, but it's not easy to get around there. Why is that? What goes on with the local tribes?
There is a lot of corruption in some of these areas. So in pretty much every country we go to, you know, from the capital cities out to the outskirts where we travel, you know, the from the government forces to the local police forces to the local tribesmen. It's not always easy to get around, and you sort of stick out as a physician, you know, traveling some of these remote regions. But, you know, I remember even some of these countries, when you arrive in the customs area, you know, they stop you and oftentimes will give you a hard time. When I was traveling recently in one of the countries, you know, pretty much every police checkpoint, you get stopped and they ask you what you're doing there. And you tell them, I'm a physician, I'm here to help. And so they say, okay, thank you. But, you know, they still want something more. So, and we started to realize that, you know, some of these local tribesmen, even the local police will want either money from you or they want food. And so we, you know, we're kind of used to either, you know, paying them off with some money or food, or, and that's one of the ways you have to get by in some of these areas.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. From my mind, that's pretty crazy. Here you are doing God's work. You're helping the communities who have virtually no medical care of your quality. And these ladies, unfortunately, have these major problems urologically, pelvic related as well. And you're basically getting shaken down. Was there one instance where your colleague had to come up with some other idea because he was fed up with what you guys were going through?
Yeah, we were in one of the countries. It was probably about 6 or 7 years ago, and we a lot of the healthcare facilities that we work out of are funded by a Christian or some Catholic institutions. So we were in a van that was a church van, and it had, you know, the church's name on the outside, and we were driving, and, you know, I'm the Jewish doctor traveling in the church van with you know, patients of all sorts of you know, ethnicities and religions. And at one point, we ran out of money and ran out of food to give the tribesmen that were stopping us. And so at one of the last stops, you know, they stopped us. We rolled down the window and they said, "Who are you?" And my colleague who was with me points to me and tells the guy, "Padre, padre," which means father. And he was saying, you know, he's a priest. And and the tribesman says, "Oh, thank you, padre. Go on.
That's pretty crazy. You know, one of the things that you had also told me to get ready for the show is that what you find is that your organization, Growing Hearts of Africa, you don't care about the people's religion, their political beliefs, or their issues. You just want to focus on getting people better, getting them all better. And that, once again, is the beauty of people like you, is it doesn't matter what your race is, what your religion is. You're going there, and really you're doing beyond God's work. You're putting your blood, sweat, and tears, literally your life on the line to make the world better. And that's a blessing. I only have a few more minutes with you, Doc, because, I mean, we could go on and on. I mean, your stories are really, you know, from my perspective, mind-blowing, hopefully the listeners, because it's an eye-opener, because we all take things for granted. I mean, just the way life's mysteries are. You don't know what you have, and so you go somewhere else, or if you lose it, you cherished it. You would have cherished it more. Do you have any advice for the listeners regarding volunteerism and giving back? I mean, I had some friends on last week, Dr. Goldstein and his son, Zach, and we talked about God's gifts. They have gifts of dentistry. They can help. They do remote area medical. And they go to Tennessee, which is beautiful. And you're going around the globe. Do you have advice for listeners about getting involved and finding in their heart the charity of what it's all about?
Yeah, I think it's important to find something that you're passionate about. You know, if you have the means here, it's great to travel to some of these remote regions. If you don't have the means, there's a lot of local organizations that are great. My kids are involved in everything, and our family's foundation is involved in other organizations, from things like Trickle Up to Getting Out, Staying Out to the Rutgers Future Scholar Program. You know, some of the local charities that are here. So find something that you're passionate about and go volunteer and help, and you can really make a big difference with a little bit of effort.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible the things you're already doing around the globe and even here locally as well. So, Dr. Michael Ingber, I just want to say God bless you again. Your wife, your sister-in-law, your entire family. When I say family, everybody that's related to you, because you're beautiful people. You're giving back. You're making the world better. I'm proud to have you on today. And that's what the show is about. It's about bringing people on that are doing their best to make the world better. Dr. Ingber, once again, is a shining example of those that take their God-given talent and ability, and it's pretty incredible to think about his level of skills. He goes around the globe to make the world better. And I think about how you touch one life, how it could change the trajectory of not just that person's life, but their family, their village, their community, their country, their continent, and their world. We need more people like Dr. Michael Ingber. As we all talk about on this show, I want to bring people on that make the world better, that understand it's not just about them, it's about doing the right thing when no one's looking, to find it in your heart to give back on the journey of giving. Because if you think about it, if we're not in this together, what's the point? Because one person doing a good deed can change everybody's life. That's why I believe shows like this are important. So if you know folks that are giving back, that are making the world better here locally, across the globe, contact the ToddLeonardShow.com. Give us a call at 973-920-7900. Each week, it's a true honor to come before you and bring people on like the good Dr. Michael Ingberg. So everybody, enjoy the rest of this weekend. God bless you, and please tune in next Sunday.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to LeonardCharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.